To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show or to volunteer to help with it. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info or to have any of these websites repeated to you. 430-9722 is the number. Another upcoming event this week is Buy Nothing Day, which their website describes in this way. For 24 hours, millions of people around the world do not participate in the doomsday economy, the marketing mind games, and the frantic consumer binge that has become our culture. We pause. We make a small choice not to shop. We shrink our footprint and gain some calm. Together, we say, enough is enough. And we help build this movement to rethink our unsustainable course. For more information about Buy Nothing Day on November 25th, see www.adbusters.org. Here's a song by Jay Unger and Molly Mason as we enter the holiday buying season.
Things are crazy in this country of ours. Everybody's selling something from diet pills to cars, all guaranteed to make us happier than we are. But I ain't gonna buy it. We used to be the land of the free. Now we're the land of 700 channels on TV, and on each one's a commercial aimed at me. But I ain't gonna buy it. I'm tired of people trying to sell me stuff. Don't they know that I've already got enough? No matter how you flaunt it, I'm never gonna want it. So I ain't gonna buy it. Boarded and TV'd about all the things I'm missing, all the things I really need. Well, it's just one great big load of corporate greed. And I ain't gonna buy it. We've all heard that it pays to advertise, even if those ads are all a pack of lies. It took me many years, but I got wise. And I ain't gonna buy it. I'm tired of people trying to sell me stuff. Don't they know that I've already got enough? My bank account is low, my closet's full and so I ain't gonna buy it.
You know, marketing used to be something that everybody did. They took a basket and went to the store and got what they needed. Now, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, just about the only one this country has left. And consumption used to be a disease. It still is.
Next time you find yourself at the mall, at a great big sale for Christmas, or summer, spring, or fall, just remember, you already got it all. And say, I ain't gonna buy it. And now they're trying to sell me a war, one that's quick and clean and safe, as long as you're not brown or poor. But I can't quite figure out just what it's for. So I ain't gonna buy it. And I'm tired of politicians talking tough. Don't they know that I've already heard enough? No matter how they spin it, I don't trust it for a minute. And I ain't gonna buy it. I'm sick of all this selling, and brother, hear me yelling. I ain't gonna buy it.
Another alternative activity that you can participate in during this holiday season, when many traditions stress peace on earth as a key message, is to attend any of the Seacoast area ongoing peace vigils, which occur every week. Here are some local possibilities for you to consider. Thursdays, from 5 to 6, there's a peace vigil in front of Town Hall in Exeter, New Hampshire. For more information, contact Peggy at aquaho@juno.com. Also on Thursdays, from 6:30 to 7, there's a silent vigil for peace in front of the Dover Friends Meeting House, 141 Central Ave, Dover, New Hampshire. All are welcome. For more information, contact Barbara at 603-742-3694. On Fridays, from 5 to 6, there's a peace vigil in Market Square in Portsmouth. For further info on that one, contact Macy at 603-433-4119. On Fridays, from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., there's a silent peace vigil in front of the Parson Main statue on Main Street in Rochester. Pat can give you more information about that one. You can contact her at Frisella, F-R-I-S-E-L-L-A, at worldpath.net. Saturday mornings, from 11 to 12 noon, there's a peace vigil on the traffic island at the corner of Central Ave and Washington Street in Dover, New Hampshire. David can give you more information at 603-749-9159 or ddiam@ttlc.net. On Sundays, we have two vigils in Maine. One is from 12 noon to 12:30. That one is the Women in Black silent vigil in front of the Ocean View Cemetery on Route 1 in Wells, Maine. For more information, call Betty at 207-646-5772. Also on Sundays, from noon to 1 p.m. in Kennebunk, Maine, at the Peace Pole by the First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church, there is a vigil. Contact Carol at 207-641-8663 or at hcspalding@gwi.net. We hope that you consider these vigils and your attendance at them as a way to express the true message of peace that many of us hope can shine through in this holiday season.
We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones.
We are the ones.
was Sweet Honey in the Rock with We Are the Ones. And now for Nancy Griffith with From a Distance.
From a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white. From a distance, the ocean meets the stream, and the eagle takes to flight. From a distance, there is harmony, and it echoes through the land. It's the voice of hope. It's the voice of peace. It's the voice of every man. From a distance, we all
And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dolores Kesterson, mother of an American soldier killed in Iraq, who describes her grief and anger about the war that took her son and over 2,000 other U.S. soldiers' lives. Paul Silverstein, associate professor of anthropology at Reed College, who examines the root causes of street violence by mostly minority youth across France. And Dave Hamilton of the Sierra Club, who talks about the Expose Exxon campaign, which is informing the public about the giant oil company's windfall profits and its leading role in resisting measures to reduce global climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Chicago Tribune reports American reconstruction work in Iraq is dependent on cheap, mostly Asian laborers who enjoy few protections. In spite of objections over human trafficking, the U.S. government is allowing Kellogg, Brown, and Root, a division of Halliburton, to work with subcontractors who hired laborers from Nepal and other nations. Working for clients in the Middle East, brokers search remote areas of Asia for labor, often making promises of jobs in safe areas like Kuwait, while sending them to war-torn Iraq. Foreign workers usually have little choice but to stay in Iraq and pay off large broker fees. In June, the U.S. State Department put four Middle East nations, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates, on the top of the list of nations engaged in human trafficking. All four countries supply labor to U.S. bases in Iraq. In September, President George Bush waived sanctions against Kuwait and Saudi Arabia for their cooperation in the war on terrorism. Although there are no official figures on foreign labor in Iraq, estimates by the Iraq Coalition Casualty Count, third-party nationals make up more than 30% of the deaths of contractors in Iraq. The Washington Post reports the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department is in turmoil as dozens of lawyers are choosing early retirement. Many longtime agency staffers complain political appointees have cut them out of hiring and policy decisions. Over the last 5 years, cases on racial and gender discrimination have fallen by 40%. Agency lawyers are now handling more human trafficking cases and other immigration matters. The Justice Department has also taken heat from Democrats for endorsing the new Georgia law requiring voters to provide government ID at the polls. However, the law was recently overturned by an appellate court who compared it to a Jim Crow-era poll tax. Democrats in the U.S. Senate have also complained about problems of morale and enforcement in the Civil Rights Division. The Bush administration has only filed 3 cases under the Voting Rights Act for discrimination against minorities. That includes a reverse discrimination lawsuit accusing a black-majority county in Mississippi of discriminating against white voters. Veteran agency lawyers worry about their loss of influence as a flood of young conservative attorneys are hired at the department to work on civil rights cases. With a combined estate of $90 billion, descendants of Walmart founder Sam Walton are the richest family on earth. Until the death of Sam Walton in 1992, the family gave away little money to charity. In fact, the founder of Walmart had little use for good works, seeing charity as a tax on shareholders and consumers. As Walmart rose to become America's largest private employer, it has become more image conscious. It has used the company foundations to fund small community projects and to bankroll right-wing groups working on the abolition of the estate tax and to establish charter schools. With its clout as a low-cost, union-free, big-box retailer, Walmart has made lots of enemies. It faces a massive sexual discrimination lawsuit. Communities in New York and California have rejected its stores. And the company has spent millions to fight Robert Greenwald's new film documentary critical of Walmart. While Walmart and the Waltons have worked to avoid any estate tax, the company has been awarded $1 billion in federal subsidies to build new stores. Meanwhile, some Walmart workers are paid such low wages they're eligible for Medicaid, food stamps, and public housing. A recent congressional report shows employees of a typical Walmart store receive over $420,000 in public benefits, more than 10 times the per-store giving of the Walmart Foundation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
After months of White House and Republican Party scandals and growing opposition to the war in Iraq, President Bush has gone on the offensive, attacking critics who assert that he lied the nation into war. The president, speaking on Veterans Day, claimed that those who accuse him of manipulating intelligence to justify the invasion and occupation of Iraq are sending mixed signals to our troops and hurting the war effort. But the president's credibility won't be easy to repair. According to a Newsweek public opinion poll conducted November 11th and 12th, only 36% of Americans approve of Mr. Bush's job performance. 68% of those surveyed said they were dissatisfied with the direction of the country, the highest number during the Bush presidency. More worrying for the White House is the 50% of Americans in this poll who believe that Mr. Bush is not honest or ethical. Since the death toll of American soldiers in Iraq has passed the 2,000 mark, more Americans support a withdrawal of U.S. troops. But the numbers of dead and wounded alone cannot convey the toll that the war has taken on countless families across America. Dolores Kesterson's son, Eric, an Army Chief Warrant Officer 1, was killed in Iraq on November 15, 2003, while piloting a Black Hawk helicopter over Mosul. She has spoken out against the war in a one-on-one meeting with President Bush and held her ground against right-wing cable TV host Bill O'Reilly. Here, Kesterson describes her grief and anger about the war that took her son's life and daily continues to claim American and Iraqi lives.
He was killed on his first mission. He was so dedicated, he wanted to save lives. He didn't go over there to kill. He knew he would be there, might have to kill or be killed. And he was a Black Hawk helicopter pilot, brand new pilot. He had just graduated on July 11th of 2003, and he was killed on November 15th of 2003. I was hoping that he would be, one of the type of pilots that would be saving people in New Orleans and those Black Hawks that, would be here in the United States to take care of that situation. And that would have been just right what he had, enlisted for, to be saving lives. And unfortunately, he was killed on his first mission and he's gone. And 2 years of his possible 60 years of life are lost. And what he might have become and, who he might have saved and the good missions he could have flown, they're just out the window, gone.
Dolores Kesterson, what are your primary concerns this year as the nation honored those who have fallen in combat this Veterans Day? What are some of your big concerns?
Well, the price we paid, and what did it get us? Our kids lost probably 60 years of their lives, and the wounded who have lost, limbs and who knows what, mentally, that they're going to have to live like this for the rest of their lives. And what did it get us? And, I'd like to see our troops come home and save our troops. That's how you support our troops. And I'm just having a hard time with, the fact that we're sending 18-year-olds out there, and they're dying. And I know some, 18, 19-year-olds, not even having reached 20, not even having been out of high school for 1 year, and they're dying. And yet and still the Iraqis are not trained, the Iraqis who have been in the Iraqi army and have been trained supposedly as the Republican Guard, the finest army in the Middle East, and they're not ready to go in there and take over and take their own country. There's something wrong with that when we're killing our own 18-year-olds. We're putting them out there to go clear out houses and take the IEDs. There's something wrong with that.
What are the American people not hearing about with regards to the grieving family members of soldiers killed in Iraq and the enormous loss our nation is suffering in this war?
Well, being blanketed with, not showing the flag-draped coffins coming home. And, the enormous loss is for these lives and what they could have been. This is reality. This is not the apprentice show. This is not looking the other way. This is reality. This is going on over there every day. I mean, these guys are being blown to bits. And, what are we getting out of it? It just doesn't make sense to me. And what I'm afraid of is this is starting World War III. I would say we shouldn't have been there in the first place. I would say we would have needed really concrete evidence that there was a reason to go in there. And apparently, from what we're hearing now is that the desire was there, but the evidence was not. And, things were tweaked in order to sell that war. And I'll tell you, they did a good job of that. It was really to the point where we were all being scared that we were going to see a mushroom cloud if we didn't go into Iraq. Nobody knew why Iraq. You know, they knew why Afghanistan. Bin Laden was there. But I don't think anybody knew why Iraq, you know. But in any case, they were selling it on weapons of mass destruction, anthrax, and every fear that you could possibly have. And, you know, I am no genius, but I thought, you know, we've had these weapons inspectors in there all these years, and they found nothing.
President Bush chose Veterans Day to attack his opponents, basically saying that those who accuse him of misleading the nation into war were hurting the nation's war effort in Iraq. What's your reaction to that?
Well, if it was worthwhile, you know, I mean, if we had really been attacked by Iraq, I personally, you know, see as just for oil and war profiteering, it all depends on your take on it. I don't think it was the time. The timing was not the perfect time. You know, we should be talking about the deaths, but they don't want to go there. They don't want to talk about the deaths and the cost of war, the price we're paying. And so it was kind of a strange thing for him to attack the other side as far as somebody holding them accountable as to why are we there. I don't know. What did we get out of this? I know what I got. A flag-draped coffin. My son's not here. He's missing out on life. He could have served in so many ways, so many heroic ways, because he was just like that. That's how he was. That's the kind of guy he was. That's what they all are. They all want to go back there and take care of their buddies. We'll never understand it, just like you'll never understand what it's like to get a flag-draped coffin. But, you know, they're willing to pay the price. They're willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And I just think it needs to be worthwhile. I think it needs to be for the right reason. I think it needs to be to really defend our country, to protect us, and, you know, save our country.
That was Dolores Kesterson. Her son, Eric, an Army Chief Warrant Officer 1, was killed in Iraq on November 15, 2003. U.S. Tour of Duty, a group giving voice to veterans and military families, can be contacted by calling area code 310-842-8794 or visit their website at www.ustouroftheduty.org. Two teenagers, believing that French police were pursuing them, hid in a power substation, but were electrocuted to death. Their deaths on October 27th set off almost 2 weeks of street violence by minority and immigrant youth that has resulted in thousands of cars burned and millions of dollars in property destruction. Many non-European and Muslim youth in France fear the police, whom they accuse of bigoted and brutal behavior. Poverty and high unemployment rates among North African immigrants, unaddressed by the French state for decades, are believed by many observers to have contributed to the unrest. In his first address to the nation since the rioting began, French President Jacques Chirac asked Parliament to extend a state of emergency until February and establish a youth training and employment program over the next 2 years. France's predominantly Muslim minority population, many of them immigrants from former colonies, have virtually no political representation in the national or local government, underscoring their lack of integration in the country. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Paul Silverstein, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Reed College. Silverstein, whose research focuses on North African immigration, religion, and politics in France, examines the root causes of France's riots.
Well, I think what we're seeing is the result of decades of warehousing of the poorer populations and particularly immigrant populations into housing projects which have been overall underfunded and heavily policed. This is not the first time in which we've seen this kind of violence, and especially property damage or confrontations between local youth and police. In fact, this seems to be a relatively regular occurrence. What is different this time seems to be both the intensity of it, the number of cars burned, the number of incidents, and the spread, the fact that we're seeing it not as simply a localized incident, but as reoccurring within a number of housing projects across all of France and into even beyond the French borders.
Are these riots, the property damage, Are they in any way an organized effort, or is this kind of just spontaneous? There have been reports, of course, about people using cell phones for instant messaging, text messaging to alert groups of youth who are participating in this unrest, you know, with where the police are. You have any sense of that?
Well, I think there are. I mean, I think within any given group, which is, say, a group of kids from a single housing project, they're all connected through whatever, through telephones or through mobile phones, and using SMS or text messaging as a way of organizing. In terms of what we're seeing across different housing projects, I don't think there's much in the way of coordination. The French state has blocked some of these blogs in which there have been calls for people in other areas to, you know, rise up and burn something. But the calls have been, you know, set out by, you know, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, kids who are just, you know, participants in these blogs. They don't have any, you know, structuring. I mean, and one of the things to keep in mind is even though there is quite a large informal economy within these housing projects, there is a drug trade, there are local gangs. These are not hierarchically structurally organized into a national system such as we have in the United States. So there isn't even at that level a kind of, you know, hyper-organization that could either organize violence or could contain violence because, of course, you know, it would be bad for business. I think it's actually quite disorganized and relatively spontaneous when we see it happen.
What's been the reaction of the government of Jacques Chirac? What would you say they've done right? What would you say they've done wrong here in response to the riots?
I think they've done two things simultaneously, part of which is good and part of which is possibly very bad. On the one hand, they have made promises of a release of public funds to these areas for things like schooling, school programs, after-school programs, internship programs, more monies for the local associations who are, you know, trying to step in and be the mediators between these communities and the state. And in that sense, the violence may spur them to do this, and which will actually have some positive effects for the community. However, there is now increasingly a politics of militarization, I guess you'd call it, in France. And it's not a new one, but it's one that certainly has been spurred by the far right, which has tried to treat kind of the immigrant problem, which is, you know, a term which is used to gloss all sorts of problems, which we would call urban problems or class problems. But they call, you know, the immigrant problem, they've tried to turn into a problem which has a policing solution. So a kind of a law and order discourse, a law and order set of policies has been adopted not just by the far right, but increasingly by just the right, including the Interior Minister Sarkozy, who's tried to respond to these events, to this violence, through calls for, you know, for pressure washing the housing projects from the scum, referring to the young kids, and that's actually winning him points. It's not hurting him in the polls. It exacerbated the problem. He said this after the second day of the confrontations, and it probably contributed to the spread of them quite directly. And he was criticized as much from within his own government, actually.
What's the outlook, do you think, for the riots and the unrest that we've seen unfold in France? It seems that over the course of a dozen or so nights, the property destruction, the rioting has dissipated somewhat, but it's still going on. What happens next, do you think?
I think next there's going to be necessarily a relative period of calm. And I think that's simply because there's only so much time and energy these kids are going to put into, you know, burning cars. There's only so many cars they can burn before they're starting to burn those of their own families. There's no, you know, organizing body to coalesce this into a national movement. I think the end game, at least in the short term, in the very short term, is just going to be the calming down, you know, gradually across the entire nation. Now, that's not going to mean that we're going to see, a final end to this kind of violence. In fact, it's been more or less constant at a very low intensity level for the last, 15 years. The fact that after 10 days of the rioting, they invoked a state of emergency law that had never been put into effect except in the time of the Algerian War on French national territory, which was mind-boggling, I think, to most observers, because it really underlined the fact that the relationship between the center and these peripheral areas, these housing projects, was still that of a colonial relationship. They were still viewed as not really fully French. In the short term, I think that general mindset will endure.
That was Paul Silverstein, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Reed College. He is the author of Algeria and France, Islam, Barbarity, and the French Nation State. ExxonMobil, the world's largest oil company, recently announced quarterly profits of $9.7 billion, its third consecutive record-breaking profit statement. The announcement came as consumers were paying record prices at the pump for gasoline, although recently prices have been dropping. A new campaign called Expose Exxon is aiming to raise awareness among Americans about ExxonMobil's windfall profits and its leading role in resisting measures to reduce global climate change, even while it lobbies heavily in Congress for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, to oil drilling. At the same time, some other major oil companies no longer deny that global warming is an issue and are diversifying their portfolios to include renewable energy sources and promoting conservation. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dave Hamilton, Director of Global Warming and Energy Projects at the Sierra Club. He talks about the Expose Exxon campaign, which is a collaboration between the Sierra Club and other environmental and public interest groups, such as MoveOn.org Political Action and True Majority.
ExxonMobil is the largest oil company, and they've been the most destructive in terms of the environment and maintaining a dependence on oil that is unhealthy for us. They have been very active in contributing to those climate skeptics, those hatchet guys that run around trying to cast doubt on the reams and volumes and piles of science that have come in that the climate is in fact changing, and that it is changing because of human activity, primarily burning fossil fuels. And the Sierra Club and other organizations felt that not enough was being done to tell the American public why Exxon was a negative force in American society. You know, some other issues are they continue to press for the drilling of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge when the contribution of that oil is not going to change prices.
ExxonMobil and the American Petroleum Institute are running full-page ads in major newspapers talking about the need to tap domestic oil supplies, which, by the way, don't mention drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge specifically. But they do say the U.S. has enough oil to produce gasoline to run 73 million cars and fuel oil to heat 30 million homes for 60 years. That sounds like a lot of oil.
Yes, we have oil reserves that are not tapped, but all in all, we have 3% of the world's oil reserves, and we use 25% of the world's oil. And that equation simply doesn't stack up to an amount of oil enough to influence the overall international market.
Is this a boycott or just an educational campaign?
I mean, it's not a boycott in a traditional sense that we are expecting that enough people will stop going to Exxon stations so that the company will come to its knees and beg us to negotiate with them. You know, $9.7 billion in one quarter means they don't have to talk to anybody they don't want to talk to. For our part, this is a campaign to educate the public and really get people to better understand the negative influence that Exxon has been on the environment and the economy and as a neighbor. I mean, failing, you know, they continue to challenge the 1994 court ruling ordering the company to pay between $4 and $5 billion in punitive damages to fishermen and others who were injured by the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Can you say more specifically what is the goal of Expose Exxon? Are you promoting any particular legislation around ExxonMobil's windfall profits or its unwillingness to accept responsibility as a corporate citizen?
Well, we're very interested in a windfall profits tax, and we believe it's entirely justified. There are a variety of proposals right now, and we're kind of looking between them, and some things would fund low-income heating assistance, and some things would fund building refineries so that the oil companies can no longer be able to drive prices up because of low inventories and tight refining capacity. So, yes, we are very supportive of legislation that would redirect some of the largesse that has been picked from American consumers toward even renewable energy or more energy efficiency or things that would help wean us from oil dependence. Thus far, Exxon has not been particularly interested in spending money on those kinds of things. They say we're an oil company, and you know that's pretty much that. Then other oil companies, including BP, that have been much more willing to talk about problems like global warming, engage in trying to find solutions, investment in cleaner technologies, and Exxon pretty much says that, you know, that's somebody else's gig.
Dave Hamilton, what do you think it will take to get Americans to change their way of thinking, to focus more on reducing demand for oil rather than increasing the supply, which, of course, is the focus of the Bush administration?
Well, we have to continue to educate people. You know, energy efficiency is the quickest, cheapest, and cleanest way to deal with our energy problems. And while, you know, we need continued energy supply, you know, we can take the equivalent of millions of cars off the road. We can reduce the need for new power plants by investing in existing technology and energy efficiency. People have to understand that efficiency isn't just kind of doing a couple things like caulking your baseboards and saving a nickel here and a dime there, that it's a very dynamic, very powerful, very potent economic development tool. And perhaps the most important thing is that when you're not paying as much for energy, you're not paying them, that money's going in your pocket. And that is important to people, because I think there's a great reservoir of resentment over the fact that at a time when the economy is sluggish, you know, people are struggling, gasoline is eating up more and more of their paycheck, these guys are walking away with record profits.
That was Dave Hamilton of the Sierra Club. For more information, call area code 415-977-5500. Or visit the campaign's website at www.exposexxon.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferrio, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. We are particularly looking for more interviewers for our program. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you now with this quote from Chief Makina of the Nootka people. "Once I was in Victoria and I saw a very large house. They told me it was a bank and that the white men placed their money there to be taken care of and that, by and by, they got it back with interest. We are Indians and we have no such bank, but when we have plenty of money or blankets, we give them away to other chiefs and people, and by, they return them with interest, and our hearts feel good. Our way of giving is our bank.